People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
Many of us have known that there's a strong connection between affordable, stable housing and the health of children. Well, now we have proof. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and on this episode of the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing, we'll be hearing about the latest research from Children's Health Watch, which shows that public investment in housing, including housing for homeless families and rental assistance for families who face food insecurity, clearly improves outcomes for vulnerable infants and young children, and it also lowers healthcare costs. Our guest is Dr. Megan Sandel, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the Boston University Schools of Medicine and Public Health, Medical Director of National Center for Medical Legal Partnership, and a Principal Investigator with Children's Health Watch. She's the former Pediatric Medical Director of Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program and is a nationally recognized expert on housing and child health. Welcome, Dr. Sandel.
Hi, Joanne. It's so nice to be with you today.
It's good to have you back on the show. Tell us, if you would, about Children's Health Watch and its mission.
Sure. So Children's Health Watch is a research policy network of pediatricians and public health researchers where our mission is really to improve the health and development of children by focusing on public policies that alleviate common economic hardships. Those hardships include things like hunger, unstable housing, problems keeping the heat or the lights on. And our feeling is that if we can bring evidence from the front lines to policymakers, we can actually improve those policies and improve the health and development of young children.
You've done a lot of research on health and housing. What started you on this path?
You know, as a pediatrician, I often say that I learn the most by listening to my patients. And very early on in my career, I was admitting a child to the ICU with asthma. And we were tearing our hair out, trying to help her to breathe better and figure out what had gotten her there, because she had previously well-controlled asthma. And I ended up asking the family kind of a fateful question of what had changed. And the family talked about getting a cat. And I was mystified. Why did they get a cat? I had actually seen in her chart that she was allergic. And they talked about actually getting getting mice infestation in their house. And they actually found a mouse in this child's bed. And so they ended up making this really kind of fateful decision, which was getting a cat, which probably resulted in her coming to the ICU. And it was this eureka moment for me where I said, oh my God, the prescription I want to write now is for a healthy home. And that wasn't necessarily on the pharmacy at my hospital. We had to start thinking creatively about ways in which to make housing as a healthcare investment.
Amazing. And are there tons of pediatricians who are alerted to and attempting to address this problem, or is this a small subset?
No, I actually think that more and more we are understanding this idea of the social determinants of health, that oftentimes a small percentage actually of what we do in traditional healthcare influences health. And there's a lot in the social realm that is really important. And what I often say is, yes, social determinants of health matter, but housing is the first social determinant, that you often have to really speak to what the housing is first before you can then build in the healthcare, the education, the workforce, or other types of things.
We often say it starts with the roof, but that's just the start.
Yeah. And I think, or I even use another analogy, which is really that housing ends up as the foundation of what you're trying to do, that you're oftentimes really trying to work hard at making sure that there are these important areas that you can be successful. And what I often say is, if you don't do housing first, everything else is not going to be as successful. It's like trying to build your house on sand instead of establishing that core foundation.
How would you define a healthy home?
So I often talk about now a healthy home really has four dimensions, or even if you think about it, kind of four walls. And so the first thing is that it is of good quality, right? It is really important that you aren't dealing with things like cockroaches or mold or other infestations. I also think, to an extent, part of a quality house is one that has space and oftentimes may have good air and ventilation or natural light and not a ton of noise, right? These are all kind of positive exposures, kind of quiet and restfulness. I also think the second one is stability, that a healthy house is one where you're not moving a lot. And for a lot of our families, what we find in our Children's Health Watch research is that, you know, a certain percentage of kids are moving two or more times in a year. So they may not be homeless, like in a homeless shelter, but they're moving frequently. And that makes them look like homeless kids in terms of their health outcomes. The third dimension is affordability, right? Not having to make trade-offs between rent or heating your home and then food and other types of things. And then really that fourth dimension ends up being a neighborhood of opportunity, a neighborhood that is safe and that you can exercise and that has healthy food available and jobs. And so it's really that stable, decent, affordable home in a neighborhood of opportunity that is the healthiest home.
Over the course of your work and your practice, are you seeing more families and more children that fall into this category of not having a healthy home?
Yes, I think that in a lot of ways, again, like my clinical work speaks to these issues because I see how this affordable housing crisis really plays out on the bodies of kids. The other story that I sometimes will tell is from a clinic I do, which is for kids who have a diagnosis called failure to thrive. And we call those kids who come to our clinic, they call the clinic the Grow Clinic because we're trying to get kids to grow. Because if you don't grow your body during critical windows of brain development, right, 0 to 3 years of age, you're going to necessarily have potentially lifelong consequences. And so I had a kid in my Grow Clinic that I was desperately trying to get to grow. You know, we were throwing all these supplements and these expensive medications, and I was contemplating ordering these really expensive tests, right? Digestion tests and neurologic tests to try and figure out why this kid wasn't growing. And then the child miraculously started growing. And I was like, what happened? And it was because the family had been really unstably housed. They were switching between different family members' living rooms, and the child wasn't sleeping well, and they weren't sure where they were going to get their next meal or where they were going to sleep every single night. And that housing instability was the big issue. And they ended up getting off an affordable housing waiting list and ended up getting their own apartment. And what I say is that that, again, is a prescription that's not on the pharmacy of my hospital is enough affordable housing. And so we have to see that, you know, 12% of the patients in our Grow Clinic are homeless, and then almost 50% more are housing unstable, which either means they're moving two or more times in a year, overcrowded or doubled up, or that they're behind on their rent. And so when we think about it, you know, 60% of the patients I'm treating, the disease is actually lack of affordable housing or stable housing, and the symptom of that disease is their failure to thrive.
It's really quite extraordinary. I hear many docs talk about how they went to medical school and didn't really learn how to run a business, which essentially is what having a private practice is all about. But in your case, you're trying to practice medicine and affect policy on social issues.
Yeah, I think that more and more what I've realized is by treating patients, I can do it on a one-on-one basis, right, and help them trying to figure out housing search or other things. But that oftentimes if I write that prescription or try to get them that affordable housing, what I realize is that pharmacy is pretty empty, right? And so what we have to think about is if 3 out of 4 of my patients are sitting on waiting lists, they're eligible for housing assistance, but they can't get it, then part of my job is to stock that housing pharmacy. I need to work on a policy level to try and actually make more housing available, because then I can help not only the patient in front of me, but other patients I never meet.
What a hero you are. Well, we've known for a long time, Dr. Sandel, that children who have homes do better than those who don't when it comes to health. But now you have data to back that up. Yeah. Can you share some of what you found in your studies around specifically infant hospitalizations?
Yeah. So one of the things that we have tried to think about is really what the continuum is between stable housing all the way to homelessness. And so when I often talk about efforts to end homelessness, I say that they are wonderful, but often that's the part of the iceberg that you can see is people who are homeless, but that there's a lot of it below the surface that is really important to try and think about. And so what we have started to think about is that homelessness is something that is preventable, and that, but it's a toxic exposure that has potentially really important consequences in critical windows. And so we started looking at the timing and duration of homelessness and saying, okay, how does this matter towards whether or not there's toxic exposures that are meaningful in terms of kids getting hospitalized or other things? And what we looked at was homelessness either in the prenatal time when moms were pregnant or the after moms delivered their babies or during both. And what we basically found was we think that about 18,000 hospitalizations each year are attributable to families becoming homeless during those time periods, and that has a cost of $238 million to the healthcare system. And so oftentimes when I talk about affordable housing, people will say, oh, can we really afford to do this? And I often say it implies we're not paying for it now, when we clearly are paying for the homelessness crisis with excess hospitalizations.
And when you say we're paying for it, is this coming out of a similar pot?
So when we think about what are particularly Medicaid costs, public insurance, that is coming out of our taxpayer dollars. And so when we think about trying to decrease Medicaid costs and other things, I think we often think about pills or we think about other types of medical interventions. And what I'm trying to get us to think about is by investing in housing, we can see a benefit on another part of our line item, which is our Medicaid costs.
Which makes a whole lot of sense, but I think it's been a big leap for people to even think about putting money into health education. And that's about health, much less, right, taking that next step.
Yeah, and I think this is why I sometimes will use these, frankly, very medical analogies, right? I'll say, look, there's this pill out there that I can guarantee will decrease your hospitalizations, make you healthier, make you less likely to use preventable healthcare, or make you more likely to have less healthcare costs, and it costs $10,000 a year. And what I'll tell you is that if I show that it's beneficial and it's a pill, the healthcare system will pay for it. But if I tell you that that is the housing voucher, it won't pay for it. So I try and point out the hypocrisy of some of the choices that we're making. And so that is why I use these medical analogies, right? Housing is a vaccine that keeps you healthy now and in the future. Housing is a prescription, is healthcare, because I think we have to change our mindset about these types of investments.
Absolutely. What were some of the challenges that you faced in putting together the research, and specifically in isolating what causes are leading to the effects?
Yeah, I think that one of our biggest things is trying to think about particularly homelessness and looking at what are the ways in which those characteristics of the families may be more of what's going on than necessarily the homelessness themselves. And so we really tried to isolate what was the difference. Was it the timing of the homelessness or the duration, how long you were homeless? And I think that what's important to us is that there's really no safe level of homelessness, right? Like once you're homeless, that is an effect that is different for your population than those that you can prevent homelessness with, that it doesn't matter whether it's just in the prenatal period, say before a baby is born or after, they both are meaningful, but it's really the duration of homelessness that's the most toxic. And so it really speaks to how are there ways in which we can rapidly rehouse people or prevent homelessness in the future that becomes kind of the innovation cry of what we need to think about when we think about helping families moving forward.
Megan, how has the Affordable Care Act impacted your research into healthcare costs as linked to affordable housing?
Yeah, we're thinking a lot about the Affordable Care Act as an opportunity. And the reason for that is it really starts to say to healthcare systems, we're not going to pay you for doing the same care over and over again or doing more care. We're really going to pay you based on the outcomes that you get. And so as we think about remotivating towards health as a health system instead of a care system, we're really rethinking what is the care that is needed in order to keep people healthy. And I think that is where we are trying to say to systems, particularly those that are now called accountable care organizations or coordinated care organizations, that they need to start thinking about their high-risk groups, right? Like pregnant women that are high risk, or kids or adults that are utilizing a lot of healthcare, and being able to help them start to embrace the idea that housing can be healthcare and that they can actually see not only better health, but actually reduce costs. And so we're trying to just build more of that evidence base so that these types of health systems can actually embrace that as they shift forward in implementing the ACA.
I'm curious to know what types of affordable housing problems were included in your research.
Yeah, so we focused a lot on just this dimension of subsidy, right? The idea that you weren't having to pay a lot of your take-home income towards rent. And so we actually didn't necessarily separate out whether that was a mobile voucher, right? Whether or not you were able to rent any apartment you wanted or whether or not it was tied to a specific development. We really tried to say, okay, we are just focusing on that affordability dimension. What does affordability mean? And what's interesting is that it is, again, this idea of risk becomes really important. So we had published previously that, let's say you're a family that's food insecure, you're reporting that you're already having to make trade-offs related to food. What does a housing voucher mean to you? And in our previous research, we had showed that if you were, say, a young child in a family that was food insecure, if you received that housing voucher, that subsidy, so that you were protected from having to not spend too much on rent, you were twofold less likely to have stunted growth related to your food insecurity, right? You had some immunity built in because of it. And that's why I call like housing as a vaccine. We actually looked in infants in our most recent publication, Housing as a Healthcare Investment, where we looked at families that were reporting being food insecure while they were pregnant, and then looking at the first year of life. And we showed that there was almost a 50% reduction in hospitalizations. We think that there are 1,200 avoided hospitalizations because families were able to have a subsidy while they were pregnant, even though they were food insecure. And so I think that for us thinking forward, we have to think about ways in which we can really move the dial to focusing on the highest risk populations so that we can see the best return on that investment.
Makes sense. So we agree, of course, that housing is key. What are some of the other needs that need to be addressed?
Yeah, I think that for a lot of families, we have started to think about this concept of preventing homelessness, right? This idea that if we think homelessness is a high risk exposure that we want to try and avoid, can we identify these families early in the process? And so we actually have just embarked on a pilot randomized controlled trial research where we're trying to test housing prescriptions as healthcare. And what we're looking at is intensive case management for families, which includes maximizing the benefits that they're eligible for. It includes doing some problem-solving education as a way to help families deal with the problems that they're naturally going to face and avoid depression, which is really common in low-income families. We include in that access to legal services. And then for some families, we may be able to get them priority within a public housing unit to help them have more stable housing. And I think that for us, this is kind of the phase one drug treatment that we're trying to put together. We're saying, okay, if housing prescriptions are going to be healthcare, what's the dose response that we need? What's going to be effective? Who are the right targeted populations? And then we're going to try and move forward with kind of expanding it so that it becomes something that's more readily available. And so I think we recognize housing alone is not enough, that there are special services that need to go with housing. But I think that as we think about this idea of making housing and particularly supportive housing more available, we have to make sure that we think about it for families as much as chronically homeless adults, and that we think about marrying these and braiding these funding streams to have their maximal impact.
So in keeping with the medical metaphor, who's going to run these clinical trials?
Yeah, so this is what's interesting to me is I more and more want health institutions and medical researchers to embrace this kind of housing as a almost a medical intervention. And so it's not to say that I think that the medical institutions should be delivering the housing services. I think we should partner with housers and with social service agencies. I don't think we should build more resources within our four walls. I think we should buy more resources outside of our four walls. But I think that we have to have a rigorous evidence base. We need to be able to prove that this works and for who, because we want to start bending some of the healthcare dollar towards investing in these other health investments. It's really that ratio of traditional medical spending to social investments that predicts to the best health. And that's where I want more and more for us to try and be able to justify that spending.
So who needs to be talking to whom at this point? What agencies or groups need to be involved?
Yeah. So I think more and more we really need to build these collective partnerships where health institutions are partnering with social service agencies and with housers like community development corporations or other community development finance institutions to start to thinking about these webs of services. And this is where in the medical field, we've been spending a lot of time talking about population health, which is our way of talking about who's the population that we're trying to serve, what are the types of risk factors that we know are in that population, and how do we identify who's at high risk and who's at rising risk to try and decrease unnecessary utilization. And I want us more and more to build these bridges so that we have seamless kind of integration of these kind of social service and housing interventions so that we can target these families and these individuals early and be able to get basically the best bang for our buck.
How are you getting your most recent publication, Housing is a Healthcare Investment, out to the people who need to read it?
You know, I think one of the things that we like to do is trying to speak to different audiences. So one is making sure that the housing world knows this publication exists, because when they're trying to speak to their healthcare partners, the first question they're going to ask is, how is this going to help me? Why would I want to invest in housing? And so it's really trying to arm the housing world with the right communication strategies and the right evidence base. I think likewise, we're really interested in talking to the healthcare world and saying, hey, in the healthcare world, we need to be able to make sure that there are things available that are going to be beneficial to you. You need to start to reach out to the housing world and be able to put those things together. And then finally, we think it's really important to talk to policymakers. I was just presenting the brief to the Senate Banking Committee staff last week and saying, look, as we think about ways in which to invest in housing, we want to make sure the best evidence is available to policymakers, again, to try and help them make the most evidence-based decisions.
Dr. Sandel, how can our listeners get a copy or access Housing as a Healthcare Investment?
Great. So there's we partnered with the National Housing Conference on the brief. And so it's available both at their website, the National Housing Conference, and then it's also available at our website, childrenshealthwatch.org. And so honestly, if you Google housing as a healthcare investment and maybe put my name, Megan Sandel, into a Google search, you should be able to get the web link. And we really would love to hear more and more people using it. That's what the policy brief is meant for people to download it. It's 4 pages. It's written very simple language with nice infographics because we want it to be cited as much as possible.
I can attest to that. I downloaded it yesterday.
Great.
Dr. Sandel, your research findings are incredibly compelling. We hope they provide the evidence that's needed to further investment in affordable housing. And thanks so much for your insights today.
Thanks, Joanne, for having me. And I really enjoy being able to talk with you about the work that Children's Health Watch is doing.
Dr. Meg Sandel, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Boston University Schools of Medicine and Public Health, Medical Director of National Center for Medical Legal Partnership, and a Principal Investigator with Children's Health Watch. Hard to imagine that you have time to breathe with all that you're doing. I'm Joanne Green. For more episodes of the Affordable Housing Podcast, please visit us at edenhousing.org.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.